This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing from WNYC Radio. Come on, admit it. If you're my age, you remember exactly where you were when you first heard this. That's the sound of 25-year-old Peter Frampton performing what would become one of the top-selling live records of all time. It was 1975, and Frampton Comes Alive would change his life. He was young, but hardly a newcomer. By then, he'd already made four solo records for Herb Alpert and Jerry Moss of A&M Records. Frampton, who recorded his first album when he was 14, started Humble Pie when he was 18. Frampton's signature sound is a mixture of virtuosic guitar, a powerful voice, and this electronic device called a talk box. As it turns out, the talk box wasn't his first successful foray into the world of musical gadgets.
I realized that I was a techie when I was very young. I got my first reel-to-reel tape machine, and then I figured out that if I got another one, I could go sound on sound, you know, before any multi-tracking sort of thing, you know. And I figured that out pretty early. I was like, you know, 10 or 11. So I've been an engineer as long as I've been a musician.
Do you think that's helped you as a musician? You know, you're talking to somebody who, your music is like so important to me.
Oh, thank you so much.
Me growing up when I was a kid, and you were very young then. I mean, Humble Pie, you were a kid. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, when I was growing up, there was like the Beatles, the Stones, Zeppelin, the Who, and Humble Pie. You don't want to know what I put in my body listening to I Don't Need No Doctor.
Yes.
I mean, you don't want to know. But anyway, so, but my point is that do you think that that work has made you a better musician? Because you are such a virtuosic guitarist and such a great guitarist.
Sound is very inspirational to me. I remember the reason that I wanted to learn guitar was because I heard the sounds of all these people on TV and on the radio, electric guitar, very young. And something, I have a very acute sense of sound, and I've always had that. If I don't have a good sound, I can't play very well. So I've always worked out what makes a good sound. How do you get a good sound?
Technically.
And then one of the first sessions I ever did, Bill Wyman of the Stones produced it when I was 14. And the first engineer I worked with was Glyn Johns,
right,
who is, if people don't know, he's one of the most famous engineers of all time.
Stones engineer.
Yeah. Zeppelin, Eagles, the band, everybody. Yeah, Humble Pie. Yeah. And then being a gadget freak early on, I just was over like a little birdie on their shoulder. And I was, well, what's that? What are you doing there? I just learned how to engineer, so I really enjoy that part of it as well, immensely.
How do you end up as a 14-year-old and Wyman wants to produce your track?
Well, I started playing guitar just before I was 8 years old. And
were either of your parents musical?
Yes.
You grew up in England?
Yes.
Where?
About 12 miles south of London in Bromley, Kent. And my mother was definitely would have been an entertainer. She was, but my grandparents wouldn't allow her to become an actress. She wanted to be an actress. Her father was a singer. Yes, we have a lot of musical genes.
And your dad?
My dad played, his teacher, artist. He played guitar in a college dance band before the war, before
the
Second
War. Did you grow up hearing him play guitar?
He was more into his art.
Mm-hmm.
But he did, he was the one that taught me how to sing Michael Row the Boat, you know, with two chords, basically. Okay. And then Hang Down Your Head, Tom Dooley was another biggie for me. Uh-huh. Then it was Eddie Cochran, Buddy Holly, and our English, The Shadows, Cliff Richard and The Shadows. So that's how I started playing guitar, because of American music, obviously. That's what we all did, and we were all clamoring for American music before the Beatles.
Mm.
And then so I was known in locally as this young little upstart, good guitar player, very young. ended up in a semi-pro band still at school that had the drummer that was the original drummer of the Rolling Stones called Tony Chapman, who introduced Bill to the Stones. He didn't end up staying in the Stones, and Bill felt he owed him a favor, I would say, said, look, put a band together and I'll produce it. And he comes into the music shop I'm working on the Saturdays when I'm about 14 and restringing guitars for the guy there. He said, I want you to be in my band, you know. I said, well, I'll have to speak to Dad, you know, sort of thing.
Yeah.
First thing I know, we're in a van. We pick up Bill Wyman in Penge, who sits in the front. The van goes very quiet. We've got a Rolling Stone in the front seat. We go up to London and I meet Glyn Johns and we make a record.
Man, like everyone is talking about Soul Disease.
What was the record?
It was called Hole in My Soul, and it was a cover of an American song. And
what was the name of the band?
The Preachers. So that was it. And
so music was your entire life?
Yes.
You were in the guitar shop in Kent?
Yeah.
Fixing strings on guitars for people?
Yes, shining guitars up.
And the next thing you know, Bill Wyman's in the car, and you're off to go do Hole in My Soul with the Preachers.
Yes. Something soulful. It ain't like he walked around us so much,
his shoe fell off. What year is this?
This is 64.
So the Stones were and the Beatles were in full swing by then.
Yes. And in fact, we did that year. The Stones were given Ready, Steady, Go. They took over the show Ready, Steady, Go for 1 week. And each one of the Stones had their choice of act to be on, you know. And, of course, Bill chose us. So I'm on TV when I'm just before I turn 15.
Is there any footage of that? Do you have footage of that?
If anybody's got it, Bill's got it because he's the historian, you know. But that was pretty amazing.
Do you miss living in England? You're such an American in so many ways.
Yes.
You lived here for years, haven't you? Years.
Yes,
and years.
75 I came to New York, actually. I miss my family, my brother and his family. I miss friends and stuff, but my children are here.
Right.
When I first came to America with Humble Pie and I turned on the radio, I said, I'm moving here. Just seemed like this was the place it was all happening.
That was the old and this is the new.
Yeah, and I'd lived through the swinging 60s of London, you sure. know, and that was exciting too. And I love England, don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
I just don't think I would ever live there again. I was just, yeah. I'd be too far from my kids.
Yeah, this is home now.
Yeah.
So when you finish the Hole in My Soul on the show with Bill Wyman, he's your selection there on the show, what happens then?
Then I'm 16. It's school holidays in the summer of 66. Big local band, The Herd, come to me and say, we saw you in The Preachers and we're having a change around. Would you come and help us out for the summer?
16, okay.
So I said, okay. So it gets close to September when I'm going to go back to school, and they said, here's an offer. We want you to be the lead guitarist, and the lead guitarist is going to play bass, and we want to be a four-piece instead of five-piece, and would you join The Herd? I said, I've got to go back to school, do my sixth form, get my A-levels, and go to Guildhall
yeah,
School of
let
Music.
Me grow up.
That was my plan, to go to music college. You know?
Let me grow a beard.
You're right. At least.
Let me get a few chest hairs here, and I'll call you.
Yeah. I haven't even had a shandy yet.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, exactly.
So I went to Dad and Mom, and I said, look, I really want to do this. This is a professional band. You know, they're great. They're a big band. And my dad said, well, and they knew that this was on the cards, you know, this was coming up, that they knew by this time I was going to be a musician. And so he said, well, look, if you left here and you got a job at the post office, you'd get £15 a week. I want to get an assurance from this band that you're going to get £15 a week. I said, well, if you can do that deal, Dad, that'll be great. I don't think they earn enough to pay themselves £15. I said, well, that's what you, I'm going minimum wage for you. So that was the last deal my dad did for me because we started to become a little better and earn more money. Beginning, they couldn't pay themselves £15.
Eventually, it was a bargain.
Yeah, because they paid me £15, they got £50.
Your father was no Brian Epstein.
So that was the end of him as a manager.
Yeah.
Everything changed, and The Herd became, had like three big top 10 hits, and I became very well known. in Europe as a guitar player singer.
Now, by the time you leave the Herd, you leave them in what year?
The Herd, after these three big hits and an album, we realized that we were losing money still, and there was no reason, because we saw the figures, what was coming in and what we were getting paid and all that. So we reached out, and Steve Marriott and Ronnie Lane of the Small Faces said, look, we've been through this. We've been screwed, you know, by management or business manager, whatever. They clued us in, which was very nice of them, and said they'd help us produce a track or two on the next album we were going to do, which they did. Meanwhile, I'm sitting in with the Small Faces now at various functions and wanted to join the Small Faces. That wasn't to be. Steve wanted me to join the Small Faces, but they weren't so thrilled with that. So in the end, Steve called me up and said, look, I've left the Small Faces. Let's form a band. And that's how Humble Pie basically formed in 68.
So the two of those things closely overlapped.
Yes.
The end of The Herd and forming Humble Pie.
Yes. And it was basically two ex-Teeny Bopper stars.
Right.
Steve Marriott was like the face of 67 and I was the face of 68 sort of thing.
And by 68, how old are you?
18.
Now, you're 18 years old and you've been doing this professionally since you were 14 years old and you're in the world of rock and roll, and especially as we go from the 60s, from 64 to 68, it gets a little more grainy, if you will.
Yes.
In terms of, it gets a little more vivid in terms of drugs and my sense,
right,
of the culture. Was that difficult for you to be the underaged, you know, man-child? I mean, you're like Mozart, you're like this prodigy, but you're a kid.
Right.
And you're in this world with some pretty, I would imagine,
yes,
some pretty hard-living people.
Well, yeah. I was pretty much of a late bloomer. I had to really learn to drink, you know.
Do people expect you to?
I think so. There is peer pressure.
You're in the band and
you're,
it doesn't matter your age.
Didn't really like...
It's like you're in the army.
Yeah, exactly. You got to swear and drink, you know, and now do drugs.
Yeah.
But I passed out so many times from anxiety attacks, from pot. Look, I'm trying to get high,
yeah,
please. But anyway, I managed it in the end.
Right.
But not really when I was with Humble Pie.
What changed?
I think it was my solo career and then getting to the point where it was surreal.
Oh, we're going to get to that. We're going to
okay.
get to that.
Yeah, well, that was the time.
Right. So you're with Humble Pie and you're in England.
Yes.
And you perform with them for how many years?
68, 69, 71, 4 years.
And well, how would you characterize that period for yourself? Did you enjoy it?
Unbelievable.
Yeah. They were very popular.
Yes.
In the States as well.
Yes. That band brought me to America.
Where'd you play?
Fillmore
East. Right.
That's where we started. I mean, probably one of the first gigs I met Bill Graham. You know, how you doing? You realize now when I look back, it was the beginnings of the creation of rock and roll shows.
Yeah.
Truly. Bill Graham was the guy on how to do it live.
Where would you record Humble Pie? In London?
We recorded at Olympic, in the famous Olympic where the Stones and Zeppelin recorded. And I did all my solo stuff there as well. Either there or Island Studios, which is Chris Blackwell's place.
So you never recorded in the U.S.?
No. No, the first thing we ever did was record the live album of Humble Pie at the Fillmore.
Right. And why did Humble Pie end?
A couple of reasons. I was feeling claustrophobic in the band because we started off very democratic and doing all different types of music. And now our stage act was narrowing and we were just doing more of the heavy rock and roll, which I love, don't get me wrong. That's my riff, I Don't Need No Doctor. That's me jamming at a sound check at Madison Square Garden. And Steve just jumped up on the stage and started singing I Don't Need No Doctor over that riff. I don't need no doctor if, 'cause I know what's ailing me. He and I were very much...
That's him singing.
Yeah, yeah.
He's the one that says, it's been a gas!
Yeah, we go home on Monday.
We go home on Monday. But I want to tell you, we're not out of gas this time. It's really been a gas.
How old is he then?
Oh, he was probably a couple of years older than me.
Okay, so he's still one with the kid. But you feel claustrophobic. Why?
Well, because I wasn't being able to do the music, all of this music that I wanted to do. Humble Pie started off really split between acoustic and electric. And also I was coming into my own, and Steve and I fought like brothers.
The Glimmer Twins.
Yes, that's which is why Humble Pie was so fiery, I think, because musically it was phenomenal. You know, sometimes we'd agree and sometimes we just wouldn't agree. It was very sad for me because I knew it would upset them, but I just
you
felt
left.
That I had to – it was time to go on and
– Did you know where you wanted to go?
No idea.
You didn't.
I knew that I was – I didn't want to form another band. I wanted to become a solo artist
you
at
did.
That point. Yes.
Why?
Because I wanted to make all the decisions because I'm a complete control freak.
But seriously, did you feel you wanted creative
– Yeah.
You wanted more
I wanted
more
to try things
Elton.
That – Yeah, I wanted to try things that – maybe other people wouldn't want to try. You know, I wanted to do it. And I have to say that it wouldn't have been, I wouldn't have had a solo career had it not been for Humble Pie. I learned so much from working with Steve Marriott. I have to hand him a lot of the credit for the sort of things that he introduced me to listen to as well. Music blues and Bill Black combo and stuff like that. That was really influential to me. So that's why it was a bittersweet thing leaving. I wanted to leave, but I didn't want to leave. And then, of course, as soon as I left, the live album that I had a big hand in mixing, because I'm the gadget freak and the engineer, with Eddie Kramer, Rockin' the Fillmore, comes out. I've left right at that point. And it zooms up the charts. It's Humble Pie's first gold record. And I'm going... Holy crap. That's it. It's the first big blooper of my career. Yeah, you know, I made a big mistake.
Seems like Dad's back on the job.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
Yes.
Is he in the office again? I've Frampton it this time.
Yes, absolutely. So then it was four studio albums before we did Comes Alive, you know, and
so you
a lot of touring.
And where are you living then? You still haven't moved here yet.
I was still living in England until 75 when I finished the fourth solo record in England and then moved over. I actually moved to New York and stayed at the Mount Kisco Holiday Inn on New Year's Eve in 1974.
Swinging.
Yeah, was it?
Beautiful.
And found Bob Mayo on keyboards from the live record, in the band at the Holiday Inn. It's a long story, but yeah. So basically the first day of 75 was I was now living in America.
When you do Comes Alive, how much of the music on that is new music on that album? How much of it was stuff you mined from the previous four solo albums?
It was basically all stuff that came from the four studio albums and Rock On from Shine On was a Humble Pie track that I'd written. It was actually from five albums. So it was like 6 years worth of work mining that went into that one live record.
And for people who don't know, that live performance was recorded in multiple locations or in one?
Most of it was one location.
Which was?
Winterland in San Francisco, a Bill Graham gig, where The Last Waltz was filmed. Two nights before, we'd played the Marin Civic Center, and we'd done two shows there. So we recorded that. I think a couple of numbers came from there. Doobie War, I think, comes from there, maybe one of the acoustic songs. But Winterland was the first big headline show I'd ever done with my name on the ticket. People were coming to see me because the album right prior to Comes Alive, just Frampton, was the biggest one so far, biggest seller. It had sold like 300,000 copies, which was mega for me. That was better than all the others.
So things in that four-album run prior to the live album in Winterland, things were getting better. The sales
it was,
were
yeah. They were. But that one was definitely
on the
setting me up. It was setting me up for something.
How many nights at Winterland?
One.
One
show.
Okay. So stop. So. Let's cut the bullshit. You're in Winterland.
Yes.
And would you say, and the show goes on what time? 8 o'clock? 9 o'clock? 9 o'clock?
Yeah, probably quarter to nine, something like that.
So somewhere between you pull up to Winterland and you go out at quarter to nine, the devil came in your room and made a deal with you, correct? You signed a deal with the
devil. Absolutely, yes.
The devil showed up.
Yes.
Poured himself a drink, sat down and said, Peter, let's cut to the chase.
It was Peter Cook, actually.
It was Peter Cook.
Right.
And he said, let's make a deal.
I'm the devil.
And the devil makes this deal with you because what happened?
First of all, there's probably, if I'm not mistaken, if there wasn't 7,500 people out there, then I thought there was, but it definitely sounds like it. It's a big room. They go nuts when we walk out, and it just takes you to a different level, you know.
It felt good.
It was one of those shows when you come off and you look at the band and you just go, I wish we'd recorded that. That was like so good, man. And then we went, we did!
You did record that.
We forgot we were... You see, the event was so much more important than the recording. I don't even remember the truck being there.
Recording is June of 1975, and it's released when?
We're still mixing right up before Christmas, and then it comes out, I believe, on like January 17th or something like that.
Of 76.
January 9th or of 76. Yeah.
And what happens?
Well, I knew we were going to tour the whole year, so right after Christmas, I went down to the Bahamas for 10 days and relaxed. Before I left, we had put one show on at Cobo Hall in Detroit, which is a big room. And that's all I knew. And so I go away and I don't call anybody. I'm just on the beach and snorkeling, whatever. I come back. We've sold four shows out. And I said, what happened? You know, and the album has just started to be on the radio, you know. And that's when everything just went through the roof, you know. After all this time, people think it is overnight, but it's not overnight in the scheme of things.
No. But it's a huge leap for you.
Yes.
But it's not overnight success.
But it's a heady experience.
Is this still the highest selling live album of all time?
Or it's in dispute.
But it's up there.
Yeah, because my record is only counted as one album. A certain other artist had it made so that you could count, if you released six CD live set, you can count it six times. Well, they didn't do that retroactively. So in my mind, it's still the biggest seller.
Sure.
Yes.
And eventually, how many albums did you sell?
We're up in the 17 million now.
17 million records of this you sold. This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing, back in a minute with more of Peter Frampton. Here's the Thing is supported by LegalZoom. LegalZoom is not a law firm, but provides self-help legal services at customers' specific direction. LegalZoom has been dedicated to the needs of individuals, families, and small businesses for more than a decade. Information is available at LegalZoom.com. Use the code THETHING for a special offer available to Here's the Thing listeners. When you come out of that experience and having this huge thing, I want to talk to you not about how it affected you career-wise, because obviously that wasn't important. How did it affect you personally? Were you married at the time?
I had a girlfriend at the time.
Right.
I don't think anybody can be ready for that kind of success. And I'm pretty down-to-earth person. I take things as they come. As I said earlier to you, I was a late bloomer when it came to dulling anything. You know, it was almost unbelievable the amount of success. You get these phone calls in quick succession. You're number one in the charts, you know. And I'm going, wait a second, say that one more time.
Yeah.
And who are you? And then within 3 or 4 weeks of that, I get the call saying, it's the biggest selling record of all time. You've just outsold Carole King's Tapestry.
Right.
And it's...
Was that the time you thought you had to start numbing yourself?
Yeah, it was crazy because people just wanted...
You didn't know how to deal with that?
No, it was very hard.
You don't know how to deal with how people treat you differently?
Exactly.
How your life
changes. Being always being respectful and never really thinking of myself as anything special, because I've never been – that's just not my character.
Well, and what good does it do you?
I felt embarrassed that I was that – this entity became – it was me over here, you know. Yes, it was very hard to deal with, yeah.
But were you proud of the record?
Oh, my God, yeah. I'm still proud of the record.
Because it's one thing when people become – famous and have a, regardless of their of the ramp up, regardless of the whole timeline of their career, and then they have some seismic event like that, and they don't really deserve it. And when in your case, you're great. I mean, you really are phenomenal. But aside from your own gifts, who helped really, really make the record roll out that way? Jerry?
Well, I have to say Jerry and Herb for sticking with me. As long, they stuck with Humble Pie, too. They stuck with Police. They stuck with, well, Police happened pretty quickly. But there's a lot of acts in those days that
needed nurturing.
Needed nurturing. And it was like a club. You know, you come over here and Jerry and Herb never told us what to write or what to record. They let us do our thing and find ourselves. And I have to say, D'Anthony, the manager, was a great promoter. He wasn't terrific with finances, but especially mine. And then Frank Barcelona, the agent, who was, if you weren't with Frank, you weren't anybody. You know, that was Premier Talent was the
who
place.
Else did he handle?
Everybody. Springsteen, Led Zeppelin. I mean, everybody. The Who, the lot. Everybody.
Did that plague you at that time about finances? Did you find that that you didn't get what you thought was fair?
Well, I was ripped off. Yeah. I mean, but I would go back and talk to Bill Wyman, you know, because he's sort of like my mentor, my older brother. He said, oh, we all get ripped off. Stones, the Beatles, we all got ripped off, you know, and then you learn and you go and do it again, you know. I'll tell you why it happens. It's because I'm a musician. I'm a creative person. I've never done what I do for money. I'm stupid when it comes to money, you know.
And you left a lot of money on the table.
Yes. So I trusted people to look after things for me, and they didn't. They took it.
Did that change after you had the number one selling album in the world?
Well, that's when it happened. That's when it started. And some people it'll happen to over and over again, but I have a team now that I wish I had then, obviously. But and I've become – I actually tutored myself in math a little bit after that. Mm-hmm. No, but it's – you know what I mean? I have to blame myself as much as I blame everybody else.
I mean, you almost want to believe, as I do, that I couldn't do – you might not have been able to do the work you did on the level you did if your mind was on something else.
Yeah, When something really big hits in the entertainment business, it's like feast or famine. It's either – it's not a hit, movie – record, whatever, and nothing comes in. Or it's like a blockbuster and all this money comes in and it all comes into one place. And when you see a pile of money like this, it brings out thoughts that people didn't normally have before. You know what I mean? It's the availability of all that cash all at once, you know, that...
Well, especially in the music business, because there's nothing like the music business for making money.
Except for the fact that music is free now.
Well, it is different now, yeah.
I mean, you used to tour to promote the record.
And now?
Now you make the record to promote the tour. The record is a giveaway. The CD is a giveaway.
The dollars are on the live performing.
Yes.
That's how it is for you.
Well, yeah, that's all.
And
that's
most
all.
Artists.
Yeah, and luckily my reputation is as a live performer, so it's been phenomenal for me. But it's hard work touring, but I love it, so that's not hard work for me.
You came into New York recently, and you did that at the Beacon here in New York, correct?
Yes.
And how many shows did you do?
For most of 13 months, we were doing 5 shows a week. And it's a 3-hour show. So we were doing Comes Alive first, which is 1:40. And then we were doing excerpts from everything else in my career as well for another 1:15 or 1:20, you know. So it was we were killing ourselves.
How did it feel?
Well, it felt great. The first show we did was in New Jersey.
The first time you did Comes Alive concert
yes.
style?
First time we played it since 76.
Okay.
You know. And then the second show was the Beacon. The place went nuts.
Yeah.
You know, they just went berserk. You know,
are you going to do it again?
I don't know whether I'll do the entire thing again.
Will you do Comes Alive again?
Not for a while, okay. Anyway.
God damn it.
No. We filmed it. And,
you did film it?
Yeah, at the Beacon and in
what are you going to do with Milwaukee. That? Where is that going?
It's going to be a DVD. In fact, that's where I'm going on Sunday to go back home to my studio to mix the audio.
What are you going to do with it? You're going to release it as a DVD or DVD, as a film,
yes,
in theaters or on TV?
No, it'll probably just be a DVD. And
you don't want to do this on TV?
Oh, I'd love to. Yeah. Have you got an in there, maybe?
Oh, I can't believe it. If it's a document, are there any backstage footage?
I've got the story, and it's filmed of when my guitar was returned.
What happened to that guitar? What's the story?
Well, first of all, we're talking about the guitar that's on the front cover of Comes Alive, which I got given to me by Mark Mariani in 1970 when I was playing the Fillmore West with Humble Pie. And I was having a terrible time with the guitar that I had at that night. And Mark said to me, you know, I could see you having problems with that. You want to try my Les Paul tomorrow? I said, well, I'm not really big on Les Pauls, but okay. All right. Anything's better than this. So he brought it to me. I played it. I don't think my feet touched the ground the entire night. It's the best guitar I've ever played. You know,
54 Les Paul.
54 Les Paul. So then I played that guitar on Rock On and also of Humble Pie and also Rock in the Fillmore. That's the guitar I use on there. Basically, I use that exclusively. It's the only guitar I play all the way through all my solo records, and including Frampton Comes Alive.
And you were never tempted to put that down? But you, that was it.
That was
you
it.
You married that guitar.
Yes. Yes. It was just this one. I had a 55 Strat that I would always use for Show Me the Way because I needed a cleaner sound, you know. So that was on Show Me the Way. So then we get to touring South America in 1980. We just finished playing Caracas, Venezuela, and we had a day off. And so we flew commercially to Panama, waiting for the gear to arrive on a cargo plane. Well, it never got off the runway in Caracas. It crashed on takeoff. My road manager came to me. I'm having this huge meal on my day off with my wife at the time. And he said, I got some bad news. And he says, the plane crashed on takeoff. I said, my guitar?
Yeah.
He said, mm-hmm. And like six people. Loading people, the pilot, co-pilot, loading inspector, all that. So,
they were killed.
Yeah, oh people died. So that took precedent over everything. Then it put it in perspective, you know. And there's the pilot's wife sitting at the bar who doesn't know yet. It was horrendous. So anyway, we limped through the end of that tour, basically, with borrowed equipment, sent someone down, my guitar tech at the time, a week later to see what was left. Nothing was left, supposedly. And what had happened, the tail had broken off. Guitars were actually in a trunk.
In cases.
And the way the story goes is they had a guard to guard the crash site, the debris site, till the insurance people came down. And he decided that the guitars would be much safer at his house.
No.
Yes. And
then, in Caracas.
Yes, in Caracas.
This is 1980.
1980. 2 years ago, which is 30 years.
30 years later.
I opened my info@frampton.com email, because anybody can email me, and I see them all. I open up this one, and there's a picture, a photograph of my guitar. Slightly singed, but but it's my
gloriously singed.
Right at the top, you know. Slightly singed, but there it is. There's a picture, and I thought, could this
be? You see this picture where?
In an email to me from someone who'd got a hold of the guitar as it happens in Curaçao, which is a little island off the coast of Caracas. Someone had sold it to this gentleman, and he took it to someone who fixed guitars, and they knew what it was. And it took 2 years of a very gray area.
And was he saying, like, I don't want to get processed. I want to get this guitar to you, but I don't want to go to jail.
That was the thing. No really? One wanted to actually
come. It
wasn't
about money. It wasn't about him. He wanted to.
There was money involved.
He would have appreciated a gratuity.
There was a reward talked about. But every time it would get close to someone coming in, they'd find something, reason why they couldn't come in. So that's why it took 2 years. And then in the end, the guy actually checked to see if we had booked him a hotel, because he just saw himself in handcuffs at Miami Airport.
Yeah.
You know, he knew who had it, and the person who had it needed some money. And so he went to the tourist bureau of Curaçao and said, look, if you lend me the money or give me the money to go buy this, I can find this. This will be a great tourism story for Curaçao. And
they did.
And they did. And they came. And the two of them, the tourism president of the tourism board from the government and the gentleman who found the guitar, knew where it was, brought it to Nashville. We had three cameras as soon as he walked in.
Waiting. And what happens?
Well, the two gentlemen walk in and he's got it in this, probably one of the worst looking gig bags I've ever seen in my life. Cheap old plastic thing. He puts it beside him, you know, and he tells the story in broken English of how this person had it and the whole thing. He hands it to me and he goes, feel it, Peter, feel it. So, and I know that he knows because it was the lightest Les Paul I'd ever played. So I just felt it in the case and I went, oh, this could be it, you know. Opened it up. I just looked at it and I just feel it like that. And I go, it's my guitar.
And how badly was it singed? Where?
Just around the very top. It lost the binding around the headstock.
Did you get that replaced?
No, I didn't.
You left it.
I've left it with its battle scars.
Yeah.
Gibson made it playable.
Yeah.
So we refretted it.
You call that the Caracas kiss.
Yeah.
On the tip there. Does it sound the same? Does it feel the same?
Oh, my God.
It's not damaged at all?
No.
Just that singe.
Yeah, and when I first played it at rehearsals with the band, everybody had this, like, Cheshire Cat grin on their face because it has this sound and it sounds like Frampton Comes Alive. You know, you don't have to try too hard.
And you got that back when?
I got it back just before we started touring in February and March for the last American leg. I used it a little bit at rehearsals and then I brought it out for the first night at the Beacon. I think the guitar is more famous than I am now, so.
But you were meant to play that music with that guitar.
Yeah.
Isn't that incredible?
I remember saying to someone that before I went out that night, I just hope emotionally I'm going to be able to play it. And I brought it out for Do You Feel? And I messed up the first lick because I couldn't believe I was playing it. How can you fumble? Me, I did.
It's okay.
It was like meant to be, you know. And once I got, it was saying to me, come on, get it together, you know. And yes, I'm back, now get over it, you know.
Peter Frampton has just completed his 35th anniversary tour of Frampton Comes Alive and says he plans to release the DVD this fall. In addition to celebrating his past, he's also busy with new projects, including a collaboration with the Cincinnati Ballet, which will debut next spring.
What music do you listen to now? Who do you like?
Right now, this week, Band of Skulls. My son turned me on to, and daughter turned me on to them, and I went to Coachella. I saw Radiohead. I'm a Radiohead fanatic. I just love them. I think they're so not mainstream, but they became mainstream because they're just so unique. It was an eye-opener for me to go to Coachella with my daughter, who's 16, and just have fun.
This is Alec Baldwin. You're listening to Here's the Thing from WNYC Radio. And if you haven't figured this out by now, I'm one of Peter Frampton's biggest fans. Here's the Thing is produced by Emily Botine and Kathy Russo, with support from Jim Briggs, Brian Cosgrove, Wendy Doerr, Ed Herbstman, Melanie Hoops, Monica Hopkins, and Ariana Picari. Thanks to Larry Josephson and the Radio Foundation, Here's the Thing comes from WNYC. Radio.
You know, I haven't said this to many people who've come and done this show, but I can't thank you enough.
Oh, you're welcome.
Because your music is so important to me.
Oh, thank you.
I mean, I have listened to you and I have loved your music and your playing for so long. I mean, it's like it's such a part of my life that I really want to thank you. You are a great, great, great musician.
Well, you're very welcome.
Thanks.